This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
Philip and Marlin for inviting me, and I'm really so sorry after this long day. I know the last one is always a bit tough. we're moving from imperial objects of desires and gifts to imperial debris as an object of desire and gifts in a more kind of spectral quality. And I will jump into anthropology style into a sort of vignette, which would I start. So in the summer of 2013, at the end of a long day, traveling to the village of a friend in the region of Mush, eastern Turkey, I found myself sitting in the vestibule of a small house. A cousin of my friend, Şevket, had taken me to see something his uncle had found together with a few friends in a field about 10 kilometers away at the site of a former church. While the rest of the family was sitting around on cushions listening to traditional Dengbej musicians, the uncle disappeared into the back of the house and returned with something wrapped in a leather rag. As he unfolded it, he revealed a small bronze statue of Mary that he placed on the floor before turning his eyes on me in apprehension. The other followed. I had not expected nor been prepared for the role that was suddenly ascribed to me, that of the Western expert. An awkward silence filled the room as I sorted through my confusion. The finder of the trove eventually addressed me. "So, what do you think of it?" I had a closer look at the little statue, barely the length of my hand, and wary that I was about to extinguish the spark of hopeful anticipation, I replied that it was not an unusual object to me, that there were probably thousands of similar statues all over the world, wherever Christianity had spread. The man took the piece back into his hand, weighed it, and said, "It's so light. I think it's empty inside." The statue made rounds, wandering from hand to hand. Şevket took Mary's head in his mouth in order to taste and thus identify the metal. Another relative got on his knees to imitate Mary's particular posture, with his left arm bent upwards, back straight, chest protruded, as if embodying the statue would formulate a clue. Everyone speculated on what she might be holding in her hand. Someone claimed it is not Jesus, but some holy water that she's sprinkling around. The statue's contours had faded. Edges and cracks had been rubbed smooth or filled with dust, such that it really was hard to determine what she was doing with her hands and arms. Someone pointed out the lines and a relief on the statue's pedestal, indicating that it once might have been an inscription, just that it had been worn off and could no longer be deciphered. If only someone, so the hope that filled the room, could provide that piece of the puzzle, knowledge of a scripture faded to illegibility. Treasure hunting, or definecilik as it is known in Turkish, is a widespread pastime in the majoritarian Kurdish region of Mush. Although shared across the range of political affiliation, income and ethnicity, it is an almost exclusively male affair, attracting disproportionately the young and unemployed. The area is one of the poorest and structurally most disadvantaged of Turkey. Purposefully impoverished by the central state in its decade-long war against the Kurdish movement, there is no industry to speak of and little formal sector employment. Against the horizon of everyday survival, and now, I mean proper survival, in a mood of dread and hopelessness, treasure hunting lures with its playful and exciting mixture of adventure, wittiness, and comradeship. Armenians, who had populated the plain and made up a sizable proportion of the city's inhabitants prior to the genocide of 1915-1916, are believed to have buried their valuables, fearing violence and deportation, and hoping for a later retrieval. This belief now feeds on geographic imaginary that turns this land of burned villages, internal colonization, and genocide into a land of dormant economic power, of an invisible plenty whose riches await those witty and skillful enough to uncover them. People refer to these riches as hazine, another word for define, or they simply talk about altın, gold, more precisely Armeni altın. Gold and treasures are indexed as Armenian, such that one literally comes to stand for the other. an ubiquitous reference that turns the treasured objects into an acknowledged evidence of the Armenian history of the area. It is embedded within a broader nostalgic discourse, one that features the former inhabitants as vanguards of a now lost modernity. When Armenians still populated the lands, wine factories and vineyards beautified the slopes surrounding the city. Clay pipes transported grape juice and milk down into the valley. Armenians were skillful artisans, mastering the most elaborate techniques of working metals, stones, and other materials tied into international trade networks. What speaks through this nostalgic discourse is a more intimate knowledge of the Armenian history and of the violence that led to its end. When compared to other parts of the country, where the state's program of crass genocide denial has succeeded to more thoroughly ban from consciousness any awareness of this part of Ottoman and late Ottoman history. Yet keeping in mind that large parts of the local Kurdish population participated in and stood to gain from the genocidal persecution of their neighbors, it also raises the question as to the potential of treasures to mediate an encounter between present inhabitants and the former makers or owners of the coveted objects. In that respect, the ethnographic vignette with which I have opened this presentation indicates how treasures are approached in a gesture that accords them a capacity to communicate. Shevket's uncle and his relatives inscribed, a kind of indecipherability that charged the statue with another purpose, with a potential to speak of more and to point to an elsewhere. Cradled and contemplated, the little statue was thought to communicate some intention across time. Charged with messages left by its maker or last owner, it is thereby akin to the many stones and formations across the landscape, symbolically shaped themselves or bearing crosses and lines that are held to be the elements of an assemblage signaling the sites of buried treasures. Key to success is thus the acquisition of expertise in a form of semiotic reading of signs and symbols that are thought to have been left intentionally strewn across the landscape or condensed within particular objects. Ideally, this knowledge is paired up with tools and technologies such as gold detectors and/or maps provided by an Armenian source. Armenians are believed to have inherited knowledge of their ancestors in the form of verbal and visual descriptions of buried treasures, of sites of buried treasures. Relations with them are thus sought out and nurtured. And yet, despite the pursuit of such relations, despite the constitution of treasures as mediating objects and their embeddedness within a discourse that returns us to a mournful past, it also becomes clear that the semiotic and mimetic reading and deciphering engaged in by Shevket and his uncle that day is essentially future-oriented. Even if a kind of archaeological drive is turned towards the object, it does not translate into a philological curiosity pointing to origins conceived of as founding the present locality. Instead, signs are projected onto and out of the statue, which, if only their deeper meaning could be deciphered, would provide further guidance towards another treasure or to a substitute of cash value. Carefully wrapped and stored away, the little statue is thereby animated and charged with an aura. In its association with a pre-modern artisanship, objects that are made to stand for the Christian history of the area are turned into ciphers of the authentic and original, which is a prerequisite for their commodification within a market of antiques. So the past that echoes is irretrievably lost. Walter Benjamin famously related the aura of works of art to their production within a domain of tradition whose operations are distinct from the logic of technical reproducibility and which furnishes their materiality with durability and the capacity for, I quote, historical testimony. It is its biography that provides an object with aura, the way it can absorb the marks of the hands that made it and of those it passed through time. Auratic objects following Benjamin thus enable an experience of temporal proximity, an exposure that can bring out involuntary memories and of the conditions of production and the histories that connect people and objects. And yet, Shevket and his uncle are not unsettled or otherwise affected by what might emanate from the object's history of making and circulation. The aura appears dominantly to be the result of an investment. I have seen cheap metal bowls made in China and half-broken polyester statues be handled with the same wonder and care, which leaves us not so much with the history of the objects and their production as with its intersection with the history of desires invested in them, that is, with their quality as fetish. Michael Taussig has famously described this quality as that which, I quote, absorbs into itself that which it represents, erasing all traces of the represented, a quality that becomes all the more pronounced in moments of destruction. The force inherent and unleashed in acts of defacement, importantly, has its source in the representational logic of that which the object is part. I quote again, defacement as an inherent property of power's power lies within the phenomenon to be defaced. More precisely, it concerns the constitutive power of the constitutive secrecy of power, what Taussig calls the public secret, that knowledge, that the most important social knowledge that consists of knowing what not to know. Death is the most important force endowing the fetish and the state, and or the state as fetish, with spectral life. Taussig's clue that the fetish secures its effectiveness by erasing the traces of that which it represents provides an understanding of how fetishized objects attract and accommodate the public secret. In this case, it is the death, violence, and dispossession that lies at the foundation of contemporary life in the region, more specifically, the murder of its Armenian population. The treasures absorb the traces of an Armenian past of the region and erase them by transforming them into markers of a generic pastness that severs them from their history, from the history of their making and circulation. This is ever more so when the objects are offered up for and are transferred into a market of antiques where aura becomes a matter of branding, a concept around which actors negotiate and contest value claims, submitting it to a logic of substitutability. The history of the murder and dispossession of Armenians thus charges these objects with powerful attraction, one that also expresses itself in the libidinal energy unleashed in acts of transgressions that are essentially that happen in digging what are essentially sites of death. Yet this particular history becomes untethered and shrouded in the process of fetishization such that in the end it has little to do with the objects themselves. Because the power derives from the phenomenon that is defaced, from the charnel ground that feeds current desires, the actual origin of the object is ultimately insignificant. The homage, so to speak, can fall on anything that is symbolically shaped or marked, especially if it has been unburied. Death thus comes to generate value. The treasures, especially insofar as they appear as statues, jewelry, ancient coins, or other types of antiquities, are coveted as singularities predating the age of mechanical reproduction. It is as ciphers of the original, as fetishized emblems of a past's pastness, valued by reference to their inherent finitude and scarcity, that they promise wealth. It is only because these objects belong to a past that is definitely past that they can harbor such potential for future redemption. Treasure hunting is thus an essentially speculative and future-oriented endeavor, oriented towards the generation of value by inserting these objects within a market of antiques. As their specific historicity is denied, it appears as if these treasures extracted from the ground are actually coming from the future. They fill dreams of the future. They are not given by any human body. It is a matter of pure perception, pure reception. Are they then constituted as pure gifts, coming out of nowhere with no strings attached and no debts incurred? In his discussion on the gift, Jacques Derrida foregrounded the role played by measurement and calculation. Contractual relations, those that were assumed to emanate from a dynamic of debt and obligation accompanying the exchange of gifts, were in fact, according to Derrida, antithetic to the gift. Instead, the gift must always be that which is other to calculation, commensuration, and return. As opposed to the assumed way that gift-giving might work to materialize social relations over time, the gift as conceptualized by Derrida does not belong to, I quote, an economy of time. Instead, it is, quote again, the exteriority that sets the circle going. It is this exteriority that puts the economy in motion, unquote. And especially thinking in mind how the entire economy of the Turkish state is built on the dispossession of the Armenians, it's absolutely apt. The gift must neither trigger nor form part of a return. The gift must thus not only be other to exchange, which was, as Derrida admitted, a distinction that was impossible to uphold and which was therefore maddening. The gift is also excessive in advance. Excessive because, by definition, unexpected and overtaking by surprise. The potential violence this implies points to how Derrida permits us to think the gift beyond the realm of the living. The gift thus requires absolute forgetting in order not to become annulled by an act of recognition or return. This absolute forgetting is the death of the owner agency, says Derrida. In the case of treasure hunting, this is not simply a conceptual requirement, it is literal. Left behind, buried and abandoned, the treasure appears without being given, and it is left to the digger to define the nature of the object as part or not of a relational, of a transaction across time and across the border between life and death. In the process, treasure hunters eradicate the donor and thereby constitute the pure gift by withholding a return. This is not merely a symbolic act, nor one that we can securely locate in the past when it was not treasures but Armenians that were hunted down and killed. Still today, there are stories of descendants of Armenian survivors coming to Mush to look for the valuables left by their ancestors. They elicit the help, cooperation, and protection of locals, and some have ended up being killed by locals seeking to reap the full profit or by villagers feeling threatened by the return of those on whose lands they now live. Derrida does not linger on this dimension of violence, i.e. on the literal death of the donor, although he does clarify that, I quote, only life can give, but a life in which this economy of death presents itself and lets itself be exceeded. Neither death nor immortal life can ever give anything. Only a singular surviving can. Unquote. It would seem then that there must be life in excess of death, a life that survives death, in order for there to be a gift. If no gift can arise from death, then the treasure hunters attempt to constitute a pure gift through a denial of relationality to the donor must fail. The donor is bound to reappear, and it does so in the form of a curse. In the tales of treasures that abound in the area and form a narrative genre that can enliven hours of evening chat, the gold is marked by an intrinsic evasiveness. Whatever is caught is seldom there to last, rarely translating into actual riches, always emerging only to disappear into the hands of relatives or friends that fail to honor an agreement, or into the hands of the police and other government officials. Treasures can also evaporate into dust or ladybugs in the absence of the right spell break. Before their deportation and murder, Armenians are believed to have cast spells over their buried treasures. Now they are hard to come by to assist with the right words and acts. Armenians are thus seen to continue a hold or to continue to hold a make or break power, one that is thought to derive from a privileged access to knowledge and magic. Even beyond this power, treasures harbor a destructive potential. They damn hunters into a life in poverty. Many spend thousands of Turkish lira on renting cars and buying the right equipment, gaining nothing in return. Others, while digging the fundament of their houses, become themselves buried as their roof collapses. Further on the horizon threaten the stories of those who actually found something, became rich, only to die a sudden death, suffer some horrible illness, or become otherwise cursed. Thus, as the Armenian messenger is killed a second time, remaining unidentified and inaudible and eliciting no response, her voice returns as a maddening, gripping effect that slams the treasure hunter into disaster. Thank you very much.